thanks, Doug, for having me down. It's been maybe at least 10 years since I've been to the ITP. In fact, the last time may have been when I gave this talk, but I gave the seminar that Doug just referred to. I'm a modern kind of guy. I could do all the presentation from my laptop. Problem is, I was going to work a week ago, and I have this little Z3. And, you know, it's a small car. I had to put the briefcase in the trunk. So I came out of the house, and I found out I didn't have keys to the car. My daughter had been using it. I'd properly locked it. So I put the briefcase down, went back in the house, got the keys, got in the BMW, and promptly backed up over and crunched my IBM 390X. So there's a new one on the way, but I'll have to do it the old-fashioned way. You know, if you look at me, you can kind of tell it's been a while since I've been in high school. So I needed to get an expert to help me out in talking to you people. I happen to have one in the house. And that's my daughter Pamela going into junior year. And I said, Pamela, I gotta go down. I'm talking to these science teachers. And her immediate reaction was, Dad, you're not gonna get me to take physics. He said, do you know what those guys look like in that class? Now, it was very interesting she said guys, because I can tell you when I was in high school, that's what it was, 100%. And I don't know if it's much different these days, but, you know, we got a problem there. So she said, those guys look like, I don't know what she thinks about me. I don't think I want to know. I wanted to share with you, before I really got rolling, some of the excitement of this period, which five or six of us in this room were involved in. And the discovery came as a big surprise out of IBM Zurich. Turned out that I had known Alex Mueller for a long time. In fact, he was a very good friend of our program at IBM Almaden. And he would spend about 1 or 2 weeks a summer with us working on this field of what we called exotic superconductors, organic and polymer superconductors. And as you've heard before, in January of 1986, they did some experiments. Actually, it was George Bednarz. They had a big surprise. And the plots that people have shown, you know, Laura and some of the other people, of a temperature plot, I plot as a bar graph. Because in the old days, it was small. And how small doesn't make any difference anymore. It's this big now. Now, you look at Alex and George, and you know, they kind of look like the Swiss Mafia. You know, very dour looking pair of scientists. And you see Alex has got his IBM badge on. But I like this one a lot more. And that was essentially about 16, 17 months later when they won the Nobel Prize. The fastest that's ever been won for a scientific accomplishment. Now, remember that picture, because you don't see the Swiss smile a lot. In fact, I have to tell you, Bednarz is a German, but they're almost equivalent. So, but Alex, I don't think I've ever seen him smile, and I've known him an awful long time. So this is what it takes to get a Swiss to laugh. There was a question one of the gentlemen, I think it was you, asked about how the discovery was made. You know, what leads people to think about this? And I think that's an important question to take a little time. And I'll have to trash some of the other part of the talk. But I think, you know, science isn't done in a vacuum. It's done by human beings. And what they don't teach you in graduate school is a lot of the human interactions that go on. I mean, I'm sure you've all read the double helix. Well, there's a story in HiTC, which is just as good, believe me, and we'll get around to telling you someday. But Alex was a very well-known scientist in his own right in the field of ferroelectrics before he got involved in superconductivity. Now, ferroelectrics are a material which have a permanent, kind of like a ferromagnet, but they can have a permanent dielectric field inside of them. The way a ferromagnet has a permanent magnet field due to the alignment of spins. In a ferroelectric, it happens to be the displacement of a particular ion, and that displacement builds up a bunch of dipole charges that lead to a constant electric field throughout the material. And Alex is one of the great scientists in the world in this area. Now, he thought when superconductivity was discovered in reduced strontium titanate in the late 1960s, that oxides might have some magic that the other ordinary metal materials didn't have. And that magic, he believed, was this displacement of ions that could couple to the make the Cooper pairing much stronger than would be in ordinary superconductors. It's called the Jahn-Teller effect, and it occurs when you have transition metal ions or any ions that are in multivalent states, and that the displacement occurs to try and lower the overall ground state energy by splitting the degeneracy of the electrons around this transition metal. And Alex was all, you know, genned up about this. And he went to a NATO summer school in Sicily in the early 1980s, and you heard a theoretician named Chakraverty from Grenoble talk about Jahn-Teller polarons. And Alex identified it right away with the kinds of stuff he had been working on in ferroelectrics for years. Moreover, there was a German theoretician, not a very well-known guy, named Herc, who had done a complete theory of a potential superconductor where the pairing was done by this Jahn-Teller effect, very strong electron phonon. It's like taking Laura's bed, you know, mattress and putting real strong bed springs in it. So he went back and he convinced the new hire that he had just brought into Zurich, George Bednortz, who had been his student at the University of Zurich. And Alex was an adjunct professor at the University of Zurich. Now, Bednortz had been hired into IBM not to do superconductivity, not to do ferroelectrics, but to do gallium arsenide lasers. And that's what he did during the day. And at night, Alex convinced his former student to start looking at materials that might display this new type of superconductivity. And Bednortz in Zurich at that time, there was only one instrument that could do low temperature measurements, and George had to use it after hours. They first started looking at nickelates. And nickelates can, there are certain nickel oxide compounds that come with Ni2+, Ni3+, Ni4+. And they looked for almost 2 years and found nothing. Now, keep that in mind. After hours, Bednortz worked for 2 years and found nothing. One day he was in a library and he ran across an article in the Journal of Inorganic Chemistry by a group in Cannes, the capital of Normandy, Bernard Ravot's group, who had been doing similar work but on cuprates, not nickelates. And he just decided that he would try to make one of these cuprate compounds that Ravot's group had published. Well, he chose what we now know is the only copper oxide perovskite that is a metal at all temperatures and a superconductor at none. That was the material, that's the material he chose. Now, I have to tell you that that material, we call it now the 415-13 after the ratio of its cations and anion, is very difficult to make single phase. And, but Bednortz is a good materials scientist, and he made two duds, no superconductivity. He decided he might try to change the stoichiometry just a little bit, and by God, he got a mixed phase compound, which was a minor fraction of barium-doped La2CuO4. And that was the superconductor. That was the discovery. And that's what they found in 1986 in January. There's a lot more to the story. One of the interesting things to me is that, and I bet you very few people know this, Alex went to this German professor, Hecht, and offered to put him on the paper. And this theoretician said, no, I don't deserve any credit for that. You know, it's a kind of neat idea. And so he was left off the paper. Well, you know, where they won the Nobel Prize. But now Alex tells me this guy's disappeared. Nobody knows where this German theoretician is anymore. Not because of this, I don't think, but he just dropped out of sight. So one of these little interesting human interest stories. This is the kind of environment we were in. Those of you who remember this in 1987. I mean, God, we were the darlings of the media for and the press for about more than 15 minutes, I'll tell you that. What I'm showing over there on the left is a ticket that we had to the most fashionable disco in New York City at that time, in the week of St. Patrick's Day, 1987. Go to that disco, we went. The line went around the block. If you had your APS badge on, you got right in. This on the right is a story I wrote up for Nature 2 years ago on the 10th anniversary of that meeting. And we called it the Woodstock of Physics. The Woodstock of Physics was a name coined by the late Michael Schluter at Bell Labs, a very, very nice guy and great loss to the community when he died way before his time. Michael's actual term was, God, this is the Woodstock of the nerds. And we decided, no, can't say that. Got to make it more politically correct. So it was called the Woodstock of Physics and became, you know, our name for it. Now, when I wrote this article, there was a young copy editor for Nature. Now, you know, Nature is published out of London. And she sent me an email and she says, what does Woodstock mean? So, you know, time passes. So we all got famous, but not much fortune accrued, at least not yet. And I show you there's a levitation experiment. I think that must be the first public demonstration, which I did in the bar of the Marriott Hotel in Anaheim during the April 1987 MRS meeting. I didn't think of that. I should have thought of that, John. So on the lower right is something I'm going to try and tell you more about at the end of the talk, but those are obviously high school students and you can guess what they're doing, but I'll tell you their story later. Just to show you how ubiquitous the whole thing was, there's Al Schriesheim, the director of Argonne National Lab, levitating for President Reagan and the cabinet, the senior members of the cabinet. I remember us when we were at this demonstration here, we were saying, my God, they got the whole cabinet. It wasn't just Reagan, but the whole cabinet walked out to watch this. And of course, none of us mortals could do this. It had to be the director of a national lab to show the president. But just to give you, you know, an idea of the excitement of the times, which continues to today. Well, this is the title of the talk. And I think I alluded to the fact I spent most of my career looking at exotic superconductors, very strange systems. My colleague and Rick Green and I were inspired by Bill Little. We were really Bill's kids, and we really wanted to, in the early 70s, find the room temperature organic superconductor. And so we looked at all these wild systems, and somebody else asked, you know, is there a path to superconductivity? Well, the theories are beautiful, but they are qualitative, not quantitative. Compare that to the effective theory of semiconductor physics, where you don't even need to build a chip anymore. We know semiconductor physics so well, the quantum mechanics of it, that we can build it in a computer, and we know it will work when we actually fabricate it. You can't do that with a superconductor. The theories are not that quantitative. It may never be, because you're dealing with the differences in the pairing energies between two very large numbers. Best rule of thumb that I've come up with is that if you discover a new metal at room temperature, you better cool it, because you might get a good surprise. Essentially, Bednorz and Mueller, Paul Chew. Never happened to us except once. And remember, you know, Jerry Perlstein was working on SNX. This was a Kodak. It was a material actually discovered in 1890. And Jerry found out it was a metal. So at Almaden, we cooled it down, and we got a 300-degree superconductor. He's laughing. The reason he's laughing is because the units were in millikelvin, not Kelvin. So it's 0.3 degrees, and John Berlinski was part of this story as it evolved on. But in 1993, I got a job offer from the Electric Power Research Institute to come and take over a major portion of their strategic technology program, which included superconductivity. And I'd been working at IBM, a continuous employee, since I was age 17. And so I got this offer I couldn't refuse. I retired from IBM, went to EPRI, and from this background of very esoteric materials, doing quantum spin simulations with Doug and his students, and this kind of background, underwent an epiphany. I found out about applications. And I didn't quite say, you know, I had wasted my whole life. But it was a totally different environment and new experience. So that's what I've been involved in, and what I hope to leave you with is some feel for the current state of the art of the system, the frontiers and applications of superconductivity. And traditionally, they've fallen into two classes before the discovery of high TC. Magnetic resonance imaging, if you're an old guy like me with bad knees, you spend a lot of time in those solenoids, and in big physics, superconducting magnets for particle colliders. But the advent of high TC has expanded degrees of freedom of the application space that we can work in. And I won't have time to go into much more than superficial detail in any of these. In fact, I won't be able to talk about transformers at all. But I will try and touch briefly on each one of these and then concentrate on wire and cables. Now, everybody this morning said, oh, you know, Grant will talk about that. And they gave me an agenda which I'll try and satisfy. But the small-scale applications generally fall into three areas, the way I see it: communication, sensors, and digital. Now, sensors you heard a little bit about, in fact, quite a lot about the beautiful physics that John and Chang Sui have done at IBM. Incidentally, like John Curtley, I'm absolutely amazed that IBM paid me so well for so many years to have so much fun. And I hope to keep doing it with you guys. So. So that will be small scale. Now, the communications, always like to mention people and institutions. These are the players in commercial area of commercializing high TC filters for communications. The idea here is to take an ordinary passive RF filter, like a notch filter, you know, design and sophomore electrical engineering, and replace the dissipative elements with a superconductor. And what that does is increases the Q. It just sharpens up the bandwidth that you can use to filter out signals of different frequencies. Whether you're doing sweep frequency radar, trying to shoot down the bad guys, which is a pretty important application, especially if you're the pilot. Or you're trying to separate channels in personal communication devices and PCMs. And the way it works is, you know, almost brainlessly simple. And I show, you know, a couple of cartoons for typical RF filters here from several manufacturers. And Laura briefly flashed by you this figure here, which is the bandpass characteristics of a particular notch filter given certain LC components and R. And it doesn't, the blue is, the red is normal resistors, the blue is high TC filters, you know, very, very low resistance. It doesn't look like it's much different, but this is a log scale here. And there's a huge difference, particularly in what and how many channels you can pack into a particular bandwidth, and how much coverage you can get, because you can improve the signal to noise dramatically by going to these superconducting RF filters. So right now, they have what they call in the communications industry a shadow space. You know, you've driven with your cellular and you know, all of a sudden you lose it because you drive down into some valley here where the ground stations can't reach you. Well, they actually can, even though they're located in the same physical location with high TC filters, because the signal to noise is better. So they can pick this out of the background much more easily. These are installed in the ground stations, which pick up the satellite signals and then transmit the communication within each particular cell. just to give you a quick example, here's a chart. I think this is it's an STI unit. This is about the size of them, and these go in a particular ground station. And here would be the traffic, typical traffic over several days with the old filter, and with STI super filter, you get much more calls through in the same time space. One of the great figures in this area, in fact, well, you know, essentially my teacher in all the applications of communications, is John Rowell, formerly from Bell Labs and Bellcore, a great guy. And John has really pithy catch line. He says, what the customer is interested in is a room temperature device. Not a room temperature superconductor, a room temperature device. He doesn't care about what's under the covers, just as long as it works. If you put a cryo cooler in there, he doesn't care, as long as it keeps working. here's kind of the outlook for the private sector. I have all sorts of slides for the military, but I won't bother you with that. The private sector, the technology works very well. It's been field tested, it's great. The reliability and cryophobia is being overcome. If you tell somebody you've got a cryo pump in something, they think, oh, that's mechanical, it's going to fail. Well, when's the last time your refrigerator crapped out in your house? Yeah, think about it. They're very, very reliable. They cost more, but the payback analysis, in fact, in other words, the write down of the capital cost forward to the place where you're really going to need this, is beginning to be recognized by the big cellular companies. And when the interference and coverage issues converge, which they will in the next 4 years, this industry is going to blow out big time. And if you've been watching the NASDAQ, they've anticipated it. Hi, yeah. No, you can, if you have that same filter, okay, you can just pick more noise out of what's coming in, more signal out of the noise that's coming in from the handheld station.
How are the devices cooled?
They're cooled with a Joule Thompson cryo cooler. they are 77 degrees. These are thin. Conductus uses YBCO on single crystal strontium titanate. STI uses thallium 1223, discovered in my group at IBM, okay, he said modestly, again on STO, on single crystal strontium titanate, which is a perovskite that matches the lattice constants very well. These, and these are put on the top of yes, Bob? No. No, they're not. They're bigger. They're much more massive than, you know, Bill's little tiny ones. They won't be able to take the heat load of these 1-inch wafers. Yeah. Now, okay. So that's communications. There's a lot more that can be said about it. You know, if you have questions later, I'd be glad to have you explore the range of my ignorance. Sensors. These are the key institutions and key players. By the way, copies of all the talks, as I understand it, are they going to be given out?
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, email me. Okay. So these are the institutions and players in the sensor field. Now, notice, by the way, I haven't included luminaries like John and Chang, because they work down, you know, in this esoteric physics. These are guys who are actually trying to make some money in this field. So, could be John Wixlow, Vanderbilt is doing some very good work on in vivo physics. But these are, in my humble view, the major institutions and players in the commercialization of sensors. Now, these are mostly low TC. So why 4K? You get it? Hey, it's a physics joke. Try it out on your students. Well, the reason you want to use, in many instances, for sensors and for computers, for that matter, are listed in those bullets right there. And the simple fabrication is right up there. Making these thin films with these high TC materials, these anisotropic perovskites, is not a walk in the park. So the activity in sensors tends to concentrate on low TC materials. Here's one that I'm particularly excited about. Not that I have this disease, but I kind of, for my own usage, I've coined a term called magnetotomography, which includes the mapping, spatial mapping of magnetic fields from living things, whether it's the heart or the brain or whatever. And this happens to be some images of taken by a new company. In fact, it's founded by Carl Rossner, the father of the MRI magnets, who now has a second career after retiring as CEO of Intermagnetics General in getting this company started. And here's an ischemic heart, which, you know, has about, I think, about 3% of heart disease falls into this category. And it's not detected by ECG. This seems to be the only non-invasive probe that can detect this particular pathology. It's very exciting. Are there more like it? Note that this is a magnetic field pattern. There's no need to invert the Biot-Savart equations to get currents or to get a quasi-EKG out of this. All you have to do is collect millions, what the doctors do, collect millions of clinical data to identify these different kinds of pathologies. And this is very quick and very fast. Okay. This particular one, I believe, took about 7 to 10 minutes, but you're not in the tube, you know. And, you know, people freak out. Some people have to be medicated to go into an MRI. So this is a very exciting possibility. Paul Chu's institute at the University of Houston, being close to the University of Houston, that huge Baylor, Rice, Houston medical complex, is also now beginning clinical studies. Yes, sir? No. It can. But what you saw there was simply one cut through a magnetic field pattern. But you can do this tomographic study. It really, you would, in those cases, you probably would have to do this inversion into actual circulating currents to make some sense out of it. And the reason people don't do too much of that is that these, you have to know, when you do those inversions, you have to know the boundary conditions at infinity when you, you know, do the integral inversion. And that can be a tricky thing. The last one, and I'm way behind time, is digital. Now, many of you know that IBM and a number of Japanese companies looked into Josephson computers in the early 1980s. And what happened, what blindsided us, and it's a very good lesson in technology, is you got to keep looking over your shoulder and seeing where the old guys are going. Because blindsided Josephson technology in that era was the advent of CMOS. which was fast and, more importantly, very low power dissipation. So Joseph technology was sort of been put on hold for the last 15 or 16 years. Well, it's coming back, and one of the people who is a key player is Konstantin Lekharov at SUNY Stony Brook. And Kostya is one of the great benefits to the United States of the end of the Cold War, because he was a leading applied superconducting physicist in the Soviet Union, and he's here now. And if any of you are in the New York area and you get this guy to come to your school, he's really something. I mean, he's charismatic, he's great with young people, and he also can tell you how bad it was in the Soviet Union in the former days. So if any of you are in the Long Island area, you can convince him to come and talk to your students, or bring your students over to a center. He's just a wonderful guy. Problem that we're running into with semiconductors, and we need to consider other technologies, is that there's a brick wall of physics that we're going to run into in silicon computer technology about 2005, 2006. Okay, Moore's Law is going to go on a long pause, at least regarding silicon. I think you all know what I mean by Moore's Law. Okay. I mean, we're going to run into problems where the dielectric constant of silicon is not high enough to switch the channel when the silicon dioxide layer is scaled down to 3 atomic layers. Now, we can make it 3 atomic layers, but it won't have a transistor effect anymore. So we're going to run out of physics, and we're going to run out of it pretty soon. So if we want to keep scaling up computers, we need to begin to look at some other types of technologies, maybe 3-5 compounds, but perhaps these rapid single-flux quantum devices that now are being looked at by Kostya's group and several others in Japan. You always want to keep ahead of the bad guys, the government does. And so the National Security Administration is always looking for fast computers that do crypto analysis. And what they have put a stake in the ground and saying by 2008 they want a petaflop computer, you know, serial petaflop computer, not futzing around with parallel, but one CPU that runs that fast and they'll parallel them. And it just looks like if you tried to scale CMOS to do that, you would need a power plant of 40 megawatts to run the computer. If we could do it with Josephson switches, it would probably be around 3 kilowatts, about the power consumption of your kitchen range. Just to give you a scale of where things are now, the world's largest supercomputer is IBM's ASCII White, which will be shipped to Lawrence Livermore sometime in the fall. That occupies the space of 2 basketball courts and consumes 2 megawatts of power. So that's an awful lot of electricity. So this is sort of the outlook on the digital technology. Let me go right into the large scale. And again, I'm not going to have time to talk about transformers. I can talk to you offline about that. I want to concentrate on wire, which is the commodity of all power applications, and then what we're doing with cables. The big players in wires are these institutions here. There was a time, in fact, shortly after the discovery, that we thought that electronic applications would come decades before power. And for a happy accident of nature, I'm going to show you why that's completely different now. And the big applications are going to be in electric power before they are in superconducting electronics. But in order to get you there, you got to understand this. Now, this phase diagram is really rich in physics. And I had to show it because I thought my colleagues were going to tell you about type 2 superconductors, and they didn't. What they told you about was what goes on in this little strip down here that's purple called a Meissner state, below the lower critical field, where zero is really zero. Okay. And the magnetic field is really expelled. But almost nobody uses superconductors in the Meissner state. They use it at much higher fields and much higher currents and much higher, well, not much higher temp, not higher than TC, but in this range here. And what I've showed is the richness of fluid dynamics physics, which exists in these high temp, these type 2 high temperature superconductors. And thus, just let me tell you that where we actually work in power applications and electronics, for that matter, is in this region in here below this melting line. Let me give you a 10-cent lecture on type 2 superconductors. Fortunately, I'm going to have to wave my hands. But if a superconductor is a perfect conductor, you put a magnetic field on it, it induces by Lenz's law a current. That current has to flow in some thickness. The magnetic field's got to get into it a little bit, and that's called the penetration depth. The scale of that number is about a couple of thousand angstroms. Now, Laura and the others told you about the macroscopic quantum state of superconductivity. And this is one of the beautiful insights of BCS, was to identify this as the key concept in explaining superconductivity. But that really only applies down here, okay? This macroscopic quantum state. In these high TC materials, the coupling is so strong, and we don't know what the nature of the coupling is in detail. Maybe Bob will tell us later this afternoon. But it is very strong, so strong that the wave coherence of the superconducting pair is only a few lattice constants. Okay. Whereas in a type 1 superconductor, it could truly be quantum, mesoscopic, macroscopic, the whole area of the sample, volume of the sample. Now, it turns out that when this coherence length, okay, the coherence length, the pairing length of the Cooper pairs is shorter than the penetration depth, the magnetic field actually enters in and forms little cylinders of flowing current in a normal state, and those are called vortices, okay? Now, what happens when you change the magnetic field with these vortices? There's a Lorentz force at right angles, and they move. And when they move, they bang into things like the lattice and impurities. And that dissipates heat. And that's a loss. Okay? So ideally, in the state above the Meissner state, there is never any zero resistance. None. Because these vortices flow. And they dissipate energy. Now, what actually happens is, fortunately, there's enough defects in these type 2 materials that they pin these vortices, so that they get stuck, they don't move anymore, and you do have zero resistance restored. Okay. But they can become depinned with temperature, they can creep. There's a whole anthology of words that we use to describe losses in the mixed state of a superconductor that makes it not dissipationless. And those are the areas in which we actually use the materials, not in the Meissner state. So you have to keep that in mind, that it is this region in here where we actually employ the superconductors in practice. Otherwise, they would be impractical because their critical fields and critical currents would be too low. Now, let me tell you one more, you know, skeleton in the closet. Even when these vortices are pinned, and so you have zero resistance restored, as long as the temperature doesn't get too high, or the field doesn't get too high to create a Lorentz force or a thermal force to depin them, make them jump, that dissipates energy. Even though that doesn't happen in the steady state, what happens when you vary the current, even below this depinning, these vortices slosh around. They're like domain walls in a magnet, and they bang into each other and they create loss, and it's called hysteretic loss. And it's just like the hysteretic loss you get in the iron core of a transformer due to the motion of the domain walls in the ferromagnet. Physics are very, very close. So a superconductor is never zero resistance to AC. Not even in the miser stage. You want to get down, you know, to tails off into the gap. So keep that in mind. Now, wow. I'll get the word miracle spelled right next time. Okay, so tell the students that if you ever use any of these graphics. What happened was is that we found a class of materials where, I mean, here you've got this stuff that's like a coffee cup. You come up and touch it, it's brittle. How do you make miles of wire out of something like that? If you take that 1, 2, 3, grind it in a mortar and pestle, it'll feel like sand. Well, there is a compound which is a variant on this. And again, I don't have time to go into all the beautiful material science. But you see, here in the 1, 2, 3, you have these copper oxygen planes. Here's yttrium. And then in the case of 1, 2, 3, you have this copper oxygen interstitials here. Well, there are compounds called Arvelius phases in which this is replaced by bismuth or thallium oxides. And these are called micaceous layers, because they're like mica, like clay, and they shear. Okay? And if you took a powder of this, what we call bisco for bismuth, strontium, calcium, copper oxide, and you ground it in a mortar and pestle, it'll feel like graphite, very smooth and oily. And so if you take, it turns out, if you take an ingot of silver and you slam into it this bisco powder, pack it down real hard, and then draw it out like you'd swage out an ordinary copper wire, by God, it actually makes a superconducting wire. Turns out that you need to keep these planes of copper oxygen very well aligned throughout the length of this whole wire. And what happens is that you can imagine shearing like a deck of cards. And you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. Now, you know, nature giveth and nature taketh away. And the next question is, well, why do you have to do this in silver? And the answer is because that's the only material, well, palladium also, but that's even worse, that you are in chemical thermodynamic equilibrium with a cuprate, with a copper oxide. It won't work with copper, the copper diffuses through, it won't work with anything else practical except silver. And that's a main bottleneck right now in the cost. But by going through extrusion processes, you can actually make kilometer length tapes. What you do is you make little strands, submillimeter filaments, and then you pack them together and roll them into a tape. And the cross section of this tape looks like this here. And I've got some here. I can show you later. It's in the box here. Okay. I've measured it, so I know how much silver is going to be missing. So this was a miracle that occurred in 1989. We found that we could do this, and all of a sudden, power applications became very possible and even practical in some instances, despite the cost. Huh? With liquid nitrogen. You'll see. Let's see. Yeah.
What type of currents do you want?
Aha. Okay. Can you all see this? This is a 400 ampere copper distribution cable that you can it's probably out in your street and you tap off of this. Okay. So. This has got a rating, thermal rating of 400 amps, this copper cable, distribution cable. Here are four of those tapes, each one 100 amps, okay? And at DC, essentially zero resistance, not AC, but DC. So it looks, you know, kind of quasi-spectacular. However, okay, you get the point. So the answer to your question is now we're up to about I'm going to show you a project where each one of the tapes is carrying 130 amps for a distance of 120 meters. Yeah. You work for utilities, sir? The cost is it's kind of like apples and oranges in a way, because this is, you know, entirely lossless, at least for DC. The figure of merit for superconducting wire is dollars per kiloamp meter. Okay. Now, it doesn't make much sense for copper, because copper is not a superconductor, but if you look at the thermal limitations, you have for copper a cost of about a dollar per kiloamp meter. In large quantities, the superconducting wire is now at around $300 per kiloamp meter. So there's 300 times difference. Now you say, oh, forget it. And to a large extent, you know, to massive market penetration, you're right, but we have a solution to this, we think. But there are situations, and I'm going to show you one, where the cost of the wire could almost be infinite and still be cost effective, and I'll show you that. Problem is with the silver is that these are magneto-optic images, essentially polar Kerr effect images of the cross-section of one of those tapes. There's a several hundred filaments of superconductor that are running down along it. And in each one of those filaments, the supercurrent is only being carried by the red. Where it's blue, it's dead. There's, you know, TC, JC is zero. Okay. So only near the silver interface do we have regions that carry appreciable electrical current. And so we're wasting a lot of the volume of each one of these filaments. And a lot of the pressure, a lot of the emphasis that's being placed in R&D labs of these companies is trying to get more of this area here red. Okay. But this is a major challenge of this type, this generation one material. Here's the critical current versus temperature and field for this wire. And if you're used to looking at these, this really brings out the type 2 characteristic in spades. But the thing I want to tell you about is that there's a rapid degradation of magnetic field at a critical current. You can improve it somewhat by going down in temperature. And in fact, there are a number, everybody makes this big point of liquid nitrogen. Well, you don't really need to use liquid nitrogen. In motors and transformers, you can use helium gas cooled to 30 degrees Kelvin. And you can see down at 30 degrees, you're getting a appreciable improvement in critical current. So it's only really for applications like cables that you need to use liquid nitrogen. Well, 1-2-3 turns out to be intrinsically better. The problem we have is these large angle grain boundaries that exist in these powders of 1-2-3. It doesn't shear like this other compound, so when you draw it out, it doesn't self-align. Now, this is great for guys like John Kirtley, who do these wonderful experiments on tricrystals, because they use this effect, you know, to measure that that phase interference that now has shown us the condensate symmetry is D-wave. But for us guys, they're a pain in the ass. Okay, so what we try and do is get rid of these. And one way of doing that in a wire embodiment is to take and put down on, say, a stainless steel tape, a buffered layer of another perovskite, which you orient. And a popular one is yttrium stabilized zirconia, which you put down in an assist ion beam, which essentially erodes away all the polycrystals that aren't aligned in the direction of the ionic beam. And so you have a kind of a single crystal buffer layer on which you can deposit now 1-2-3, and it will actually deposit epitaxially. Now, there's no silver in this. It's a manufacturing process that's essentially quite cheap. Problem is it involves vacuum. We're trying to do this by wet chemistry. And let me make a little aside here. You know, I think you should talk to your students about, you know, to do any kind of science, you need money. And the money comes essentially from the government, at least in the initial stages. I mean, we're all on welfare. Think about it, one way or another. It's only when something starts to make a lot of money that private industry will begin to really fund it self-consistently. So for this program, we are really dependent upon the government, the Congress. And the Department of Energy budget for superconductivity, which we draw on for a lot of our R&D, is $32 million a year. I've been spending a lot of time in Washington the last 2 years learning how the sausage is made. And let me tell you, you know, read the Constitution. The Congress has got the power. Now, it's more powerful than the Supreme Court, more powerful than a president, but it has 535 fractious individuals. That's the weakness. But they have the money. And so they've been very good with us in supporting applied superconductivity. This past May, Carl Rosser and I were asked to speak directly with Senator Pete Domenici. We were in his office for an hour. It was an incredible experience. And Senator Domenici agreed to increase the federal budget to help commercialize this tape by $65 million over the next 5 years. And this is in a period of budget caps. And this is the guy who's the Senate chair of the Energy and Water Resource Committee. And so if Pete wants it, he probably will probably get it, even with this budget cap. And it just goes, you know, encourage your students to get publicly active. We need more scientists in politics, really. So this was an aspect of my work that I never expected to be involved in back in IBM. Okay, let me talk about the cables in the 30 seconds I have remaining. This is a big program. This is a program essentially I helped start when I came to EPRI in 1993. And the very first superconducting cables concept, bet you didn't know this, John, by Yuri Matisu and Dick Garwin, right after the discovery of the A15 compounds, they hit on this idea, well, gee, maybe we can make a, look at the power. I mean, that's a lot of hum, 100 gigawatts, 1,000 kilometers, all DC. But these two IBM guys, Yuri eventually became my boss, really were the first to think about using superconducting cables. There was a big project in, lasted for all about 10 years in Brookhaven to develop an AC cable. It was a technical success, but an economic disaster. What happened, this project was started back in the days when we thought we might be all going to big nukes. And so we had to wheel large amounts of power from power islands into mega urban centers. A scenario, by the way, which may come back to us in the next 25 years. But the at this time, it was, if anything, before its time. But we learned a lot about the physics of the problems that we're going to meet in high temperature superconducting cables. Have you seen some of the headlines recently? I love this. John, you know where this is? It's Hydro-Quebec. It's flat. These are the ice storms, you know, who come every 40 years. 40 years ago, there were no towers. So there's a lot of exposure to our electrical infrastructure, both to acts of God and stupidity on the part of the utilities in not repairing infrastructure. In fact, I love this. This was Chicago. You know who them is? That's Consolidated Edison in Chicago. So people get very upset when the lights go out. We are putting in, oh, this is a nice picture. This is what the streets of New York looked like when you tore them up in 1920. Can you imagine what they're like now? So we have, you know, we don't have much room underground. That's why I'm showing you this. And so we have to use, it would be nice if we could use a lot of the existing infrastructure for a new technology, which I'm going to tell you about. This is Detroit. Okay. Here's, I'm going to show you a Frisbee substation. Here is Canada, to the south. These guys legalized gambling 5 years ago. Okay? They're sucking all sorts of money out of Detroit. What's that got to do with electricity? Well, Detroit just legalized gambling to get back at the Canadians. They expect, Detroit Edison Utility expects 6 major casino hotels to be built in the next 8 years. In addition to that, they're building a new football stadium and separately a new baseball stadium. So it's like, one of the Detroit Edison engineers told me, it's like building one Detroit on top of another. And they don't have any more room. So they volunteered to be the demonstration site for the first superconducting cable, which will be installed in the utility. And this is Secretary Richardson's announcement of the project. Article by Malcolm Brown in the Times in November 1998. And again, I'm really running out of time. I want to tell you about the students, but these are the specs of the cable we're putting in. We're going to throw the switch next summer, summer 2001. The cable will start being installed in November. So it'll be a three-phase circuit, each one 130 meters, 24 kilovolts, 3,000 amps per cable. Here it is. You can come up and have a look at it afterwards. Oh, I had my hand in front of it. There. Okay. The answer to your question, liquid nitrogen runs down the middle. so this will up the power by a factor of 3, because the current copper cable is, which I'll show you here, is right here. It's 1,000 amps. This is in French because I gave a talk recently in Montreal, and you know, you compare critical currents of copper and a superconductor, it's like apples and oranges. So that cable will go in this very attractive upscale location in inner urban Detroit. Okay, this is what it looks like, you know, from a picture on the wall. Here's the transformer. The cable will run roughly in this direction here into the switch gear house 130 meters away. It'll have 5 90-degree bends on the way over. This is a plan view, again, showing the transformer, the run of the cable. Some of the bends are not shown here because they're vertical, go down. Okay. This is the where the power will come in. You know, in Japan, they generally have a pretty young girl to show scale of things. In America, we use ugly old geezers. The power will come in here, and it won't go into superconducting cables, so it comes into this manhole, but. There was some concern in building in some of the infrastructure for the cooling station would rise above the wall of the substation. And we asked the utility engineers, well, what does that matter? And he says, because people come by and shoot at the insulators. Okay. Not exactly Silicon Valley. This is the real world. We're going to put all this great stuff we've been talking about. These cables, there's 9, 3 circuits. In utility parlance, a circuit is 3 phases. And these are already been pulled out, and 3 superconducting cables will replace those 9. It turns out that this substation is in an area that Ford Motor used to have a big plant years ago. So they have experienced a real decrease in power load. There's just a lot of little light industries now. So the power load is about a fifth of what it was 20 years ago. So they have two separate 9 cable circuits. And so the other one that's in the yard will be used in parallel with this for switchover during, you know, testing periods or if there's a catastrophe. It's going to be all instrumented. It's all available on the web. There's a website. I can't give it to you because Detroit Edison doesn't want us to divulge it yet until we have the, you know, some of the other stuff in place. But you guys will be able to log on to this and actually, you know, watch the meters and the power flow during the test. This is Dave Bogdan. These are real people. This is the manager of the substation. This is Dave Bogdan, the chief engineer of the project, and it's really neat to work with these guys. What's the future like? This is important. Cost is one of the main problems we have. You know, why am I showing you the standard model? Well, because one of the neat things, I'm a consultant to Fermilab on superconducting cables. And again, and I hang out with these guys, I learn a lot of interesting things about this tunnel that they want to put under five states for the next Hadron Collider. And what they are looking at is developing guided tunnel boring technologies, only 2-meter tunnel for this particular collider design. And if they can really bring that off, and they think they can do it for $500 a meter, can you think of a better out of sight, out of mind for electric cables, gas lines, all, you know, information and utility infrastructure? So if we could do that and put in an electricity pipe, which is sort of I went back to Garwin Matasu's paper and redesigned it with high TC and liquid nitrogen. And so this is the Garwin Matasu revisited electricity pipe. And it's 70 centimeters. We could use it to deliver electricity, DC, losslessly, cooled by liquid hydrogen, which could be used as fuel at the end of the line. And so you could see you could envision, I mean, you really want to think big. I mean, global electrification, where we could envision these kinds of huge power corridors using superconducting pipelines carrying both, and if we get the TC up a little higher, maybe even liquid methane. John, see, I haven't neglected Canada. I see that's, yeah, up the James River, yeah, River Project. Now, what's the future like? Doug mentioned the fact that neutron stars, you get helium-3 type pairing at 10 to the ninth degrees. When it's that high, it doesn't matter whether it's Fahrenheit, Kelvin, centigrade, you know, it's 10 to the ninth. So I wrote a little article, which I never thought would get published. I had a lot of fun with some of my friends in the room here when I wrote this. It's for Physics Today, March meeting, May 2028. Remember that date, because I got letters on this when it appeared, thinking it actually happened. Okay. And is room temperature superconductivity possible? Well, why not? I mean, there really are no, you know, if you think of the manifold of pairing mechanisms that could apply, bosons that could glue together pairs, it is perfectly possible to have it, you know, at practically any temperature. The thing I see that's a problem would be, the material would be in a superconducting state, would not be zero resistance, because it's almost perfect to be a type 2 superconductor. And the temperature would be so high, the vortex lattice would be depinned, and you'd have vortex flow losses. Okay, I just got the hook. Remember that picture I showed you in the beginning of these high school kids? Gilroy High, California, May 28th, 1987. U.S. high school chemistry class verifies discovery of high TC. 3 months after Paul Chu and 4 months before the Nobel Prize was given. High school chemistry class. And all I told these guys was the formula. There was a chemistry teacher there named Dave Pribble, one of the most charismatic chemistry or high school teachers I've ever met. He organized this. These kids are not from the Bronx High School of Science. They're from a farm community in Gilroy that has, you talk about diversity. Those kids who come from diverse backgrounds. This fellow here, I remember, he actually became the natural leader of the project. Yeah, he played in a rock band at night. It was a senior. And these guys got into this, and they worked their tails off for 3 weeks trying to get this experiment to work. And they failed three times. They had all sorts of problems with the school. They couldn't stay overnight due to insurance. The teacher stayed with them. They stayed with them a number of nights. They got oxygen from the welding lab in the high school, metals lab. They got the nitrogen from the dermatologists. The chemicals, they raided a local junior college for the yttrium oxide, the barium and copper they had. Another problem they had was with the furnaces. Now, there was an art class. They had these kilns for jewelry. And so they asked if they could borrow them, and the art teacher said, okay. And then they started drilling holes in the top of them, according to my prescription, to introduce oxygen from the oxygen tanks. And the art teacher was very perceptive, because she says to me, won't that oxygen burn out the coils? And I said, no, don't worry about it. And all I wanted them to do was to succeed. The big problem they had was calibrating the kilns. The thermometers on the kilns were way off. So they went and borrowed a thermocouple from the junior college. And this day, like I say, they got it right 4 months before the Nobel Prize was given. And it was a very good lesson learned in how hard it can be to do experimental science, experimental physics. And at the time, by the way, Laura, this is what they came up with for the pairing mechanism. This is California. Bayes' Pauli principle. But I often quote an aging 20th century philosopher named Michael Jager, who wrote this song that I love, and I use it a lot. And science and life in general, you can't always get what you want, as these kids found out. But if you try hard enough, you just might find that you get what you need. Thanks a lot. I'm sorry I went way over. I'm sorry I went over, but that's the way I am. This is the conductor. It's hollow inside. Yeah. The reason it doesn't look that way, this is dates from 1994. Okay, and you can see it's been handled a lot.
And this is that wire.
That's that wire, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, with the filaments of superconductor, several hundred. it has to be, this actually once carried 1,000 amps. With the improvement in the tapes that have occurred since then, this will carry 5,000 amps. Okay, so that's why we had to plug it up with copper, because you have to get normal conductors onto the end of this. But in the middle, it's as thin as somebody's got the model. Yeah, right.
So the original debate when electricity first came out between DC and AC may be won by the DC guy, and Edison would be proven correct.
That's right. In fact, I have talks I gave to utilities. I have my ending slides. Utilities aren't into the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
But I have a picture of Tesla, who invented the polyphase AC system.
Right.
And which was perfectly appropriate at the time,
right.
Because just couldn't put large amounts of current DC through any kind of ordinary wire. But if we had to do it all over again, like I was telling her, if we had to design a country today, we'd probably do it with DC. reason is because, you know, we now have these big, we call them hockey puck silicon thyristors that are used in a lot of power applications to, it turns out, let me give you just one example. You cannot send DC